Thank you so much, Adam. Now we're going to have Jeremy Reid from Guy Carpenter to join us. Jeremy's going to focus on stress and scenario testing in particular. So Jeremy's role encompasses managing client relationships, developing viable client-centered solutions, all based in a thorough grounding of risk quantification. Jeremy has over 24 years' experience in reinsurance and wider fields, gained in both underwriting, actuarial, and broking roles across all classes of catastrophe modelling, both in the UK and Australia. So please join me in welcoming Jeremy.
Thanks a lot, Rashi. Yeah, 24 years experience, not bad for a bloke who's just turned 30. So what I'm going to try and do is take you from a very detailed sort of technical presentation on ICAP through into stress and scenario, talking about capital, into where APRA is going to come from as well. So what I'm going to do firstly is set the scene. So there's three ways of looking at capital and risk, just to set some concepts. So type one, I think, is the very detailed COSO type enterprise risk management framework, which can be highly detailed about identifying risk, measuring risk. So it's probably the basis behind capital models of what we're really trying to do, where we get very technical, lots of assumptions. It comes out with a key part of these models is how you interpret the outputs, but it can come out with a single number telling you what a return period is, which is great. Lots of work goes into it, but it can be very difficult to really understand what's going on. And I'm going to take you through some examples about when I was in Lloyd's and we actually had a model like that, and then things didn't turn out as expected. Number two is probably an investor point of view, where there's more judgment. There's still technical work going in, but probably at a higher level, probably more judgment in some of the assumptions that you might make, where you're making a choice, and that ties into capital as well, about launching a new product. And then the anticipate and adapt is the CEO point of view, which is probably very high level. It's about not so much a probability, it's about what's the worst case that could actually happen if I was to implement this plan, and can I handle it? And the important point is you can handle it by doing things and taking action and moving things. So this can apply to any company. So Apple, when they were launching an iPad, it could have been a complete flop. When I first saw one, I thought, what an enormous phone. I can't fit that in my pocket. But it could have been the worst case, could have been all this R&D goes to nothing, but you can adapt, you can advertise, you can do things. So it's about having a plan. And I think that's where stress and scenarios come in. It's actually about having a plan and stepping away from some of the technical stuff sometimes. A very good paper by the International Actuarial Association on stress and scenarios testing. So I'd recommend people read it, actually. And I borrowed these very good pictures from it. So the scenarios really are a future state. And they've been around a while. They're not necessarily insurance related. But the picture of the different globes through time shows a sort of visual representation of that. And they can be quite wordy. You come across them if you do MBA type stuff, where it can be quite descriptive about different ways the future could turn out. And what they use for it in a strategic sense is making sure that no matter what happens, that the decisions you take as your company is always on the sure footing. So I'll take you through a little bit of history on that. Then we've got stress testing. I guess actually we all know a little bit about that. We wobble assumptions, maybe one or two at a time, take it from extremes, from our middles, and see what happens next. And then stress scenarios is where the future perhaps turns out not to be great. So later on in today's sessions, we're going to talk about some emerging risk that trees is going to think about the future, perhaps with driverless cars, perhaps they don't crash, perhaps there isn't any insurance premium needed because they don't crash, or there could be a cyber, it could go other ways. I mean, it's a way of envisioning the future, and probably it's a non-numerical way. It's about planning for the future and making real decisions. That's the wrong one. So the scenarios came about. Shell in the 70s, which I remember. There was all sorts of oil crises, and so Shell set up a sort of research team with quite high-level people, and I'd recommend you visit their website, actually, because they've got some really clever people thinking about the future. And what they were doing is oil production was in volatile parts of the world. It could dry up. One day it will run out. So their vision of being an oil company could be actually an energy company. Where's energy going to go in the future? And the current scenarios, they've got two on where energy production will be in 2050. A couple of scenarios, it could go well for them, could go bad for them. What they're trying to do is position themselves so whatever happens, those globes that we saw, that they're going to be positioned and can make maneuvers to make sure that they're going to be fine. And they're quite wordy. They're probably sort of four or five pages long that take you through a vision of the future that seems plausible, actually. It could go either way, and it's about planning. And they go through all the technical, pestle, political, economic, social, really think about what's going on, what's going to happen. And it's not about probabilities, it's about thinking. Big fan of that. So where it fits in to perhaps some of the insurance stuff we do, perhaps some of the model measurement stuff we do, I jokingly say step away from the model, because sometimes it can be quite nice to look at your model, see a number, and think, well, that's my answer. I'm really pleased. I've got a whole load of documentation here that proves where all that came from, but you've got to really check it out, step back, think of it another way. So whenever I approach a piece of work, a technical piece of work, I usually roughly know what the answer is going to be in my head. I then do all the technical work, and if those two things turn out to be close together, I feel some sort of satisfaction, though I slightly worry that I could be wrong altogether. But if they're completely different, what it does is it makes me go back and think again. So if my prior expectation, I might well question that, or I may well question the model, but what I've got to do is enough work to make sure that it all fits together. So I think that's where it fits in. A model on its own is great and helpful. A scenario is great and helpful, but it's together where you get that power of them bouncing off each other. And I think the scenarios are accessible to a different range of possibly not so numeric people to allow them to have input into it too. And I think it's important that in terms of insurance, you've really got to understand the business. The boards have got to understand the business, and the scenarios are quite accessible and turn it into a little bit of reality. So more insurance, the realistic disaster scenarios, again, have been around a while. Lloyd's have been doing it about 20 years. I'd recommend you visit their website again, so you've got a lot of homework to do. They've got quite a nice little package of 14 compulsory scenarios. They usually come with a nice map, usually a description of what's happened. They usually give you an industry loss cost, and they'll tell you certain things like JFK Airport kaput. And what they do is they give that to the syndicates, and the syndicates all feverishly go around and work out what would happen to them, what it actually means. So Lloyd's don't tell you how to do it. It's not about a model, it's about thinking. And what you do is you go through all the risks that you're writing and work it out from first principles, what would happen here. And what really is it's about. Lloyd's do it to measure the aggregate to the market and make sure it's not going to go bust like it really did in 1992. So shortly after reconstruction and renewal, that Lloyd's thought, well, we'll not let that happen again. The UK PRA, the UK's equivalent of APRA, has just introduced 11. That's out quite recently. I'd recommend you read them. They've got some sort of strange ones like solar flares and things like that that they want you to think about. Cyber's in there. Lloyd's have actually introduced quite a technical cyber paper where they want the Lloyd's syndicates to go through a lot of detail, because some of that, I know there's a session on cyber, some of that is what is in the coverage already. May not be 100% obvious. And then Solvency II, through the EIOPA, has specified some, but slightly less detail. So probably in order of quality, I say the Lloyd ones are very high quality, easy to read, make a lot of sense. A little bit less descriptive from the PRA and less so even from Solvency II, where they've given you a lot more judgment, probably because they're focusing on a bigger bunch of people at the end, so they're giving people a bit more leeway. And then APRA is the talk following me, so it'll be interesting to see what APRA does on this kind of thing. So one of the problems, models are great, cat models are great too. I know we're going to have Michael's going to talk about cat models in a bit. One of the things is the 1 in 200 PML is actually not an event, and also it's quite uncertain. So the chart on the left demonstrates, so in this case we've got so 1 in 200 being about, let's call it 4 billion. This is a guy card slide where we've done a lot of research about how variable that number can be. And the ranges can be perhaps bigger than you might expect. So the actual number off that PML curve is contributed to by lots of events. So there's primary uncertainties, does an event happen or not? Secondary uncertainties, when it does, how much is it going to cost? So you go through all your events and think, what is the chance of that particular event getting above 4 billion for all those events? So it's contributed to by lots of different events. What a scenario does is it makes that real by actually taking that event and applying it. And what you're doing is you're severing that link with probability. So I've done this for a client for Christchurch, where I picked a Christchurch earthquake, put it on their exposure, and they got a number that was actually very similar to what they did get from Christchurch. And the Christchurch event would have been in that PML curve, but with a very small probability. So it's a very good test of what that PML curve actually means, say for your reinsurance program and the top limits, that sometimes there may be events in there. So reverse stress testing would be a good case. If you can find one of those that could send your company belly up from a literal event in there, and you depend on that probability. Firstly, do some work on that probability. Secondly, perhaps manage your exposures to not be so risky to a single event like that. So it's And it's also easy to explain and understand. This is what the lawyers want to do. So that some of their events might be a big California earthquake, industry loss, $80 billion, et cetera. So it just makes it real, does some real thinking, and does have a tangible capital impact, which is why ICAP mentioned stress and scenario. So I think they're actually very important, very real to me, and a very sensible way to check what can be very complicated looking models. So this is where it became real for me, actually. So despite being just 30, but I was in Lloyd's in the late 90s, where actually was just about getting involved. Partly because Lloyd's nearly went bust in the early 90s, and the market was soft, even softer than it is today. It was largely driven by US liability, and in a soft market, my first syndicate thought it would be great to expand into liability and do multi-year deals. They thought that was great. It probably took about 3 or 4 years to actually come through in the results that sent it hitting the central fund. So I learned quite a lot about the change of security at Lloyd's from that first syndicate. So that was the late 90s. So in late 2000, I started a new syndicate. So my first day at work in early September 2001, very happy, nice new shiny syndicate, Amlin, really big syndicate, £1 billion syndicate, very, very well run. There's only two actuaries there, so they gave us whatever we wanted. I had an enormous screen, and the days before flat screen, so there was no room on my desk actually for anything else but the screen. But it's very important to look at really big spreadsheets. So I was very happy. Day two, around about 2 PM, my wife rang me and said, "You'll never guess what, a plane flown into the World Trade Center." I sort of imagined, oh, it's going to be like a Cessna. There'll be some pilot got off course and no big deal. And then she said, "No, it's an airliner." And we looked at what it was, and Amlin wrote that risk. So straight away, that's a total loss. I went to see my boss, and panic. It was like that earlier picture of our plan was, you know, the models are all nice and we're capital managed, but actually, oh my God, trying to get on. I mean, the internet had been invented by then. We tried to get on all the news websites, we couldn't. It was all chocker. So the source of information was actually my wife ringing me up watching the TV. 20 minutes later, she said, "There's another plane going into the other building." Half an hour later, the building had collapsed. Building one had collapsed, and then building two had collapsed, and then there's a plane on the way to the Pentagon. I mean, my God, Amlin, talk about scenarios and disaster recoveries. It's like a fire drill. That was a real fire. It was panic. So that first afternoon, we all got in a room. I think it's a team game. You needed everybody. So our syndicate was marine, aviation, property, casualty, all sat in a room, all around a table, thinking, oh my God, what do we do? And leaders emerged, ideas, people emerged, some people panicked. But straight away, the airline hull, total loss, gone. So we listed probably about 600 risks from all over the business. And probably that afternoon, we had our first stab at what the number could be, where a lot of things have been total losses. We had a second version where we sort of put best estimates in. And that was my first week at Amlin. And that spreadsheet became the bane of my life for about 5 years. We had to keep tracking it. So there's all sorts of things went wrong. It hit all sorts of lines of business. So we had the workers' comp, we had PA travel, we had the liabilities for the security firm, and literally about 600 things that went completely wrong. And it got more complicated than that, actually, because the World Trade Center turns out to be about 7 buildings. We had a bit of all of them, which we probably, in hindsight, perhaps shouldn't have done. The wording wasn't agreed, which, again, it sounds like common sense. We didn't actually know what an event was. So is that one event? A terrorist attack, or was it two? Because it was two planes and two buildings. That actually turned into a court case because Larry Silverstein, who owned the World Trade Center, said it was two. A lot of insurers said it was one. It turned out to be several court cases, actually. A group of 10 made it be one event and got that agreed. Someone else got it two events. I mean, overall, it was $3.55 billion per claim for the World Trade Center. Larry Silverstein wanted, obviously, $7 billion. Reinsurers wanted to pay him 3.5. He actually got 4.55. So he got more than one. But again, after that, contract certainty became enforced in Lloyd's. Before, I mean, it sounds obvious. And it was moaned about, actually. People said, "I can't believe we have to get the wording ready." And it's like, can you see what just happened? If we'd have had that wording, the event would have been so clear. Because that was on the inwards. The outwards was the same. You know, worst case scenarios. And, you know, that year-end reserving exercise wasn't much fun. I think I probably aged about 10 years because it was quite stressful because really it could have been game over. If it was two in and one recovery, that was game over. And it took court cases and things to settle. I said uncorrelated correlation. So I probably couldn't have thought, I mean, it's obvious when you see it, but I wouldn't have necessarily thought an airline hull. and a World Trade Center building will be correlated. It's not something I would necessarily do in advance, but you can see it. It actually happened. So that's where the models and the scenarios need to work at the same time. That I've called it uncorrelated correlations. I just mean unexpected things happen that you don't see it coming. And it was a good way to learn a lot very quickly. And then the planning and the managing and the communication and the sign-off. I mean, it was all serious stuff. And the following week, to make the staff feel better, because we were in a tall building in London, we think, are we another target? We all got a hard hat to wear. So even though the year-end reserve and exercise was hard work, we wear a hard hat, look like Bob the Builder. And the whole point, I think, for threats and scenarios is really it leads to action. So for me, it's not a game, it's actually real. Think of it like a fire drill, but actually put yourself in that scenario and see what happens. And what you'll find is that you will do things differently with hindsight. So you might find there's some boxes near your fire exit. Don't have boxes near your fire exit. Get out. So, cyber scenarios is probably quite a good one. So I don't know whether the cyber sessions will cover it, but what cover is out there? Lloyds have specified a scenario of a US blackout, and it's loads of money. What cover is offered in the policies we currently write is not necessarily obvious, and you might need lawyers to argue. When you get lawyers involved, probably prices go up. I've been to some very good cyber talks by lawyers recently about how important it is to have a lawyer. But so how do you create a scenario? So I think other accumulations, there's an information note written by the actors that covers it very well about gather together a team of people, make it a bit of fun, but fundamentally apply. Richard Feynman was a Nobel Prize winning physicist, very clever bloke, played the bongo drums and sort of cracked safes, and he had a solution to any problem. It was simply write it down, think very hard, and then write down the answer. But the fact that he was a genius made it easier for him. But that's what we should do, is the thinking. I can't stress that enough. It's the that what if. And some of that, if you remember slide one, the three different approaches, the slide three, the CEO, what can happen? You can do stuff before it happens if you think about it. So that's one of the, probably a fault, if you were to have a fault with stress and scenarios, is that you might not think of that particular event, but you might. So it's worth doing a range of them, sort of, so that some people are doing, 10 or 20. I think that's great. In fact, I think it should be a bit of fun. I think it should be done as part of a team. I think you should have the underwriters in there, and there'll be wording things that you can do, which wouldn't necessarily come naturally to actuaries. We might like want to measure it and put a distribution around it, but actually, capital's probably not the best answer to some of these things. It's not have that risk in the first place. Do something to manage yourself out of it, which is the managed part of the seminar. So just to sort of recap, it's part of everything. It's like, I think, a sense check of a capital model that you can explain to people who don't get capital models. And even if the capital model's right, there's so many assumptions in there, it can be really, really hard to digest all of that. Even if you're the model creator and you go back 6 months, and it can be hard. So it's a very good way of just making things understandable, accessible, and it's severing that link with probability. It's thinking, what really could go wrong and what can I do about it? And not being over precise with a 1 in 200 or a 1 in 1,000. But the inconvenient truth bit, I mean, not having wordings agreed up front was... Lloyd's learned that lesson and did contract certainty. I think it's part of everything. So, I think we're doing questions at the end. So, thank you very much.